This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Thursday, 31st of March, 2022, last day of the quarter, last day of the financial year in Japan. We've talked a lot about that. We think maybe some of these, this rally we've seen in bonds, for example, might have something to do with portfolio rebalancing. We'll certainly know or be a little bit the wiser as we get into this new quarter tomorrow and into next week. But interesting to see that the NASDAQ 100, the technical situation there, we've talked about it quite a bit. On slide two, you can't see the 200-day moving average there because it's the June future, but the 200-day and 100-day moving averages approximately converging around the price action of the last couple of days and the actual high, also coinciding with a major Fibonacci retracement we've covered, this 61.8% retracement. So this is the big area, if you will, sort of big final retracement area for the classic resistance at a market, if this is to be a significant market top that we're going to see some follow through back lower. This is the area you would think where resistance needs to set in. Looks like, Peter, on the equity themes that we see the high beta stuff, two market direction doing poorly yesterday. That looks like the general pattern with an interesting exception or two. But what's your take on the setup here and the end of quarter and so on?
Yeah, it is an end of quarter, and we'll soon be rolling into a new earnings season. And in 10, 12 days from now, we'll get the U.S. financials going. And I think we have had an impressive rebound, a lot of hope. I still struggle to see the path to a peace deal that Putin can sell internally in his country. So I think the market will come to realize that we're still a little bit far off from that magical point. And then the operating environment and volatility. You pointed to an internal comment, or was it an earnings call comment from a CEO?
Restoration Hardware is a big retailer.
Yeah.
In the U.S., the CEO, I think it was.
Exactly, but you also have the management team of Novozymes, which is a big enzyme and catalyst producer here in Denmark, is one of the largest in Europe, and they're saying we're seeing unprecedented level of volatility and rises on raw materials, energy, and logistics. Not a big surprise. We talk about this endlessly on the podcast, but you can just sense that companies are so much under pressure. And so far, they have been extremely good at passing on these costs. But I think the Q1 earnings will really show who's swimming naked here and who can actually survive, because it's getting to be a very tough environment. And you're right about the theme baskets. We had a sell-off in the high beta. I still want to fade this rally. I think the environment is getting very tough. And on the flip side, the themes that we like, green transformation, defense, commodities sector, some extent batteries and logistics, they did very well yesterday. So it's still those to keep in mind. And I have a little spiel on commodities later in this podcast.
I actually want to be a bit of a use your own argument that I heard you make. I believe it was yesterday, the devil's advocate, the supportive reason, the reason why equities are this high. There has to be a reason, and there always is a reason. And one of those you expressed yesterday, just to make you take your own point, and that is that we have a nominal economy that is growing very, very rapidly, and we have central banks that are not very credible in terms of bringing the interest rate where it needs to be to bother to even own cash or fixed income products. So people maybe feel like the only way they can track this crazy nominal blowout is via equities. And that was the argument you made. I think it's a pretty good one, but we have to see whether the Fed can buy that credibility. That, I guess, it really is the key part of the backdrop here, isn't it?
It is a good point. I think I said something along the lines that it is, equities is a crazy nominal asset class. It grows with the nominal economy. But I think we should save the little debate between you and I later in the podcast, because it's all about nominal versus real in terms of equities and what we price equities in. But let's take the discussion a little bit later.
Let's do that. And I'll tell you, we have talking about nominal yields and real yields with these latest inflation prints. Spain out yesterday, it was at 9.8% on the headline CPI year on year. German inflation levels also reaching highest levels since 1981, I think I saw. We have European yields heading fairly impressively higher, but still lagging behind inflation. What are you looking at here in terms of yield levels in Europe?
Well, John, the big point here is that European sovereigns are now pricing a more aggressive ECB. And yesterday, as inflation numbers were released from Spain and Germany, we have seen a money market to price 50 basis points rate hike by the ECB already in October. Later in the day, these bets went out, but what we are seeing is that the market is definitely saying that the ECB should be more aggressive amid this inflationary backdrop. And I believe that today and tomorrow, we might see more of this sell-off in European sovereigns, yield curves to shift higher and bear flatten, because we have inflation numbers coming today from Italy and France. And tomorrow, we have also the Eurozone CPI numbers. Right now, there is not much to do, as we have seen, and the Bank of Japan is teaching. If the ECB stays neutral at this point in time, it would mean troubles for the euro currency, which would bring even more inflation.
All right, yeah, we have to watch this the situation closely in Europe and across the U.S., where we have a key data point up today, the PCE inflation, and I'll get to that in a moment. But interesting to see, as we've seen this recovery in European yields, we're still, I'm still rather concerned about the European growth outlook with this cloud over the economy, of course, stemming from the war in Ukraine and the input prices on the energy and power side, which have not really gone in the right direction. But that trigger on Tuesday this week, the nominal news that there was that the Russian military hostilities around Kyiv and another city were being reduced, even though we have U.S. sources and others saying that this is simply a Russian refocusing of the war in other regions, and we haven't seen any lowering in these energy prices. The euro-dollar rally has been maintained a bit here. So really critical areas. Technically, we're working into here to the upside. As you can see on slide four, those two prior major lows, the 111.85-86 area, from last November, and then the one into late January, 111.21. So we're in that zone. We need to close up above 112 and see some follow through here to argue that we're reversing this significant downward, this significant sell-off move, which was accelerated, of course, by the Russian invasion. And then on the right, you're seeing that Japanese yen reading still at incredibly negative levels, but the momentum has come off there as we've seen a decent-sized consolidation in bond markets. This is the last day of the Japanese financial year, as we've emphasized. We have seen big calendar roll effects in the Japanese yen. Even if there's in a secular downtrend or uptrend, you'll sometimes see a very significant pause for a month or 6 weeks with that roll into the new year. So curious to see if that happens. I think if global bond yields start to rip back higher again, there won't be much of a calendar effect beyond what we've just seen this week on the roll of the quarter, the role of the Japanese financial year. And readings quite muted elsewhere. China, with its weak PMIs, official PMIs overnight, especially on the services side, down at 48.4. So the Chinese services sector in contraction. There are those concerns about COVID lockdowns, the Shanghai dealing with that, but sending some pretty strong support signals from the official sources that they want to do something about the economy, both the State Council and the central bank. So you have China moving to ease when you have the rest of the world moving to tighten. A very, very interesting backdrop there to see what the nature of that potential easing would be and support into the economy. There was a number of substatements, some of those linked to property. I think the disruptions of the property market have been absolutely enormous, and we'll have to track that story. It has huge implications for the Chinese sentiment and the Chinese growth outlook. Okay, we also need to talk about a very key development overnight. Johansson, Mr. Commodities, we have U.S. President Biden, after a day in which crude oil prices had kind of ticked back higher, the whole effects of this Russia news in Ukraine having been neutralized. But then we have oil selling off again on an announcement from Biden on strategic reserves. Take us through that, what your perspective is there, and what we should be looking for next in oil here.
Well, it is all about the impact that the rising fuel prices has on inflation around the world, especially in the U.S., where gasoline price at the pump are at the highest we've seen for a number of years. We got a midterm election coming up, and Biden obviously is increasingly under pressure to do something about it. So we have already seen strategic reserves being released now during the past 6 months. total of 80 million barrels was has been agreed that can be released. So far, around 50 million barrels has been sent into the market, but the impact so far has been limited. So they are basically continuing rolling out the big bazooka now, basically adding 1 million barrels of crude oil into the market, potentially for a duration of 6 months, so 180 million barrels to offset the losses that we're seeing currently in Russia. But also, I think a message to OPEC that the US is very unhappy about some of these key producers not doing more to support lower prices right now. So we'll see. We could see an announcement already today. It could also include actually increasing the ethanol blend into gasoline. That would not be good for the grain market. So we can talk about that a little bit later. But overall, it may have an impact. But from what we've seen in the price action so far today, which has been and the oil market generally has been incredibly volatile recently, and that volatility remains. We are already trading almost $2 above the low point we reached overnight. So the market is not buying it. Or not believing it's going to have a major impact at this point. It also comes on a day where OPEC Plus meets to rubber stamp an agreement to increase production by 432,000 barrels. We all know that that's not going to be achieved, especially with Russia's exports falling right now. But they are not prepared to address the elephant in the room at this point. So they will just probably just have a very brief meeting and not do anything apart from what is expected.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the U.S. so aggressively drawing down that strategic reserve pool. And, you know, at some point it becomes less strategic and more tactical. But I guess to be fair, if I recall, the original ambition with that strategic reserve was to be able to replace 3 months of imports. And we have, due to the, you know, renaissance and growth in U.S. production, it actually has more than that. So it's around 6 months, if my math was very rough math was correct, that I did this morning, that entire strategic reserve at current levels, just below 600 million barrels, is about 6 months of net imports and would be 587 days at Biden's rate. Of course, they're not going to draw the thing down to zero, but just for rough perspective there. And it does erode, the margin of safety as they draw that thing down. So it'll be interesting to see how that the market absorbs that. And then, as you mentioned a little bit, you alluded to a little bit on the food front. I shield my eyes at the thought of ethanol being increased, but that's a different issue. But what's the latest here? I mean, we have this enormous wheat move. It's kind of stabilized in a nervous range. What are we looking for next? I guess it's as we look into the planting season is the next key.
Indeed, John. And we actually today have one of the, I'll say, top two most important reports in the U.S. Crop calendar coming out. It is the planting intention report that comes out at 4 o'clock GMT this afternoon. It is the first survey-based report, basically looking where farmers are giving their passing on information about their acreage or their planting intentions for the coming spring planting. And given the extreme volatility we've seen in grain prices so far this year, with wheat up 32%, corn and soybeans are up more than 24%. There's a great deal of uncertainty. The survey range has not been this wide in a number of years, so we should really expect some volatility. But what we need to know is obviously keep in mind is that corn is more fertilizer intensive than soybeans. Soybeans right now is trading at the widest premium to corn since 2014. So that obviously does favor a pickup in the core soybean acreage, which is also what we can see in the table here on slide 6. At the same time, we've had some drought conditions across key growing areas, which favors later planted soybeans. So all in all, a report that's looking for potentially, if these are all coming true, then we could see lower soybean prices due to a bigger acreage. But at the same time, corn could be supported, because if we do get an increased ethanol blend mandate, then the demand for corn will remain very strong. So all in all, expect a very volatile report today. I'm sure from a bread perspective, we want to see an increased acreage for wheat. That's also what the survey is pointing to, but we'll see. But expect volatility this afternoon.
Okay, we'll have to look out for that. Another interesting story, not at all related, not much of a segue here, but it's we need to bring it up. And I'll say you've provided a slide here, just some thoughts on what's going on before I lead into your slide on the Russian ruble, which has nearly reachieved the trading range it was trading before the invasion of Ukraine. A couple of reasons that could be driving this. It's quite shocking in a way, and some of it is just a show of brute strength and Russia doing all it can, the central bank doing all it can to stabilize the currency. But as well, there's the perspective that with this incredible recent rise in energy prices, it is still making money on its export side. So bringing in revenues from still exporting oil where it can and natural gas where it can, and we still have natural gas shipments going into Europe, for example. But then on the import side, because of the comprehensive sanctions, its import bill has dropped dramatically. So ironically, the net trade and current account situation goes even more positive for Russia, more positive for the currency. So that's one of the drivers. But then we've also just seen on the on the sovereign debt front, which absolutely exploded for obvious reasons in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine, it's come down quite a bit. So you've got some perspective on that, Alcea, as we watch for how Russia scrambles to stay away from default here.
Absolutely. I'm going to take you on a slide number 7, where we see that the cost of insuring against the default in Russian government debt has plummeted substantially since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. However, I believe that what the CDS is showing right now is that it's pretty much linked to headlines regarding the conflict in Ukraine rather than the fundamentals, because there are still several obstacles that corporate and government bonds in Russia have to face in order to service their debt. Recently, we have seen Severstal missing a coupon payment, not because the company didn't have the cash to pay investors. The company sent the cash to the payment agent, Citigroup, but on last minute, Citigroup asked the company to get permission from the U.S. Office of Foreign Asset Control before remitting the cash. And that that resulted in a considerable delay that made Severstal missing the 5 days grace period that expired on Wednesday night. So basically right now, investors could call a default on the company. And the big question is that next week, on the 4th of April, we have a Russian Eurodollar government bond maturing. And the big question is, will Russia be able to pay its investors like it did a few weeks ago with a coupon payment in dollar, or would it find the same obstacles that the corporate bond market is facing? So definitely the chances of defaults are still pretty high. And even noises of a resolution of a conflict doesn't really remove sanctions, which, if they continue to be imposed after the conflict, will increase default risk as a whole.
Yes, we'll need to look at this story as the days and weeks progress. I think given the backdrop here, and as indicated with the ruble reaching the range, even if there is a default, I think that fact is a little bit of egg in the face on those countries sanctioning Russia. But of course, let's see what happens as we grind on here. All right. I like your, speaking of nominal equities, Peter, nominal against what? And you had some thoughts yesterday. I think you put it up there as well that if you look at how equities are performing versus real stuff, so some hard assets like commodities, it's really not that impressive. So especially since over the last year or so. So take us through your perspective and what you're pointing out there.
Yeah, it's we're on slide 8, by the way, and we have had two major negative periods with equities priced in something else. And the 1970s were the worst one, as you can see on the chart here. So it's basically, I've taken the total return of the MSCI World and the Bloomberg's commodity index on also on total return. So they are scaled. So equities basically priced in commodities. And so the inflation during the 70s were terrible for equities in real terms. So whether you adjusted equity returns for inflation or commodities, it was bad. In nominal terms, that's why it's so important, equities were probably flat almost for 14 years. And then we had the second commodity boom, which started around the late 1990s, as you can see, and it lasted to around the financial crisis. You had a big underperformance again For equities against commodities, and then you have had two sort of intermediate periods with just flat performance, basically commodities rising as much as equities, and then, and sorry, but I want to paint a broad picture here, so let me try to get to my point. So after the financial crisis, you had a very, very unique period in recent history. So you had very, very cheap energy. You had cheap commodities in general, and then you had the rise of the digital companies, which are extraordinary in the sense that their return on invested capital, their asset-light models, were something we had never seen before, and they can generate a lot of profits and economic activity with very little input costs from commodities. It's a totally new phenomena, and the big question is: so what happens now? We this success of the digital age had created a massive underinvestment in the physical world. And that has been sort of a loan or a debt, if you will, that we need to pay back now. And we're 15 months into a drawdown of equities against or priced against commodities again. And so this is, you can get caught up in these short-term noise of news, etc. But I think the big picture here is that equities in real terms are priced against commodities or inflation. That's the big trade over the next 8-9 years. So that's my big point.
Yeah, and input prices, not just on the energy side, but also on the side of those things that are supposed to be the new energy and things like electric vehicles. Not to mention input prices for other alternative energy sources. And lithium has been a big focus, but there was a big news item out overnight, and you've got that in your stocks to watch today on slide 9.
Yeah, so Biden, it's rumored that the White House, the administration, plans to use what is called the Defense Protection Act, which is an act that came into fruition during the Cold War. And it allows a U.S. administration to order domestic production of key national security assets. And in this case, they're talking about things related to batteries, magnets, etc. And that's, of course, part of this end of globalization. The wording end of globalization has been used by many among us, but also other commentators. It probably won't be the end of globalization. It's just a change of globalization. And one of those are these critical metals. So you had MP Materials, which we show here on slide 9, have been galloping the past couple of weeks, but were up yesterday. Also the lithium miners, there's something called Lithium Americas, I think, if I remember correctly. But there, just look at this entire space. It's part of a bigger trend that we'll see domestic production and subsidies domestic production being favored both in the US and Europe. And then I want to highlight H&M. They're down 8% last time I checked. Some have riding 10%, but they came out with a worse than expected earnings from the last quarter. They are under pressure. The supply chain and input costs are still bad. The war in Ukraine have closed their retail network in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. So that's also a hit to revenue. And then they're still lacking a little bit on the digitalization. So they need to pull up their sleeves and swing into action, because I don't say they're losing out, but they need to get into the fight very soon. Otherwise, they will be overtaken by other companies like Zalando, which is coming from behind at a very rapid speed.
All right. And just one small correction. It's the Defense Production Act.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No worries. It just we did have a user correcting us on the natural gas. So we appreciate users chiming in on this when we make a mistake, where I wrongly said that the Dutch natural gas forward was based on the same energy unit as the U.S. natural gas price. Of course, it's not. It's 8 even different currencies. So, of course, the Dutch one is in euros. The U.S. one is in dollars as well. The direction is correct. We do have natural gas in Europe costing on the order of 6 times more than the U.S., but that is not the 20 times or more that would have been the case if I had been correct. So just that's great to have users fact-checking us there. As well, defense is spelled the American way in the Defense Production Act, but that's an even smaller detail for that one. But yeah, I think it's very interesting. And actually, on the note of that Defense Production Act, you have these crazy headlines that the U.S. is running out of money to fight COVID. The craziest idea I've ever heard in my life, when you've got these drug companies that have made the profits they've made off of COVID, at this point, not just putting them under the Defense Production Act, saying, look, you're going to make this at cost for a fifth dose, if that is what is needed to fight the next round or the next variant, et cetera. Just an interesting, I think that we'll have to reach for that if there is another round of vaccinations required. All right, let's round this off with the macro calendar for today. We have the PCE inflation levels expected, and this is tardy relative to the headline, the CPI from the BLS, which is already out, let's call it 3 weeks ago-ish. But we have this PCE number today, and it is expected to show a new high for the cycle. That plus the jobs data, and we had an ADP print, by the way, showing private payrolls jumping another almost 500,000 yesterday for March. If we see average hourly earnings also up strongly together with a strong non-farm payrolls, and I think there's no little chance that we're going to surprise strongly on the downside from the PCE. Surely the window is open for the Fed to, if it's going to do something, if it's going to try to buy back some credibility, to do something potentially next week. Peter, actually, I'm going to interrupt the calendar coverage here. You had a little discussion this morning or a point that you felt that financial conditions were still tightening. I'm not seeing that. Volatility, yes, is one aspect of it. We've seen that volatility drop in the equity market, at least very strongly, but also on the credit side, massive tightening in spreads on both the corporate side, high yield credit, and on emerging market debt. Yes, nominal yields have risen quite aggressively, but to me, the Fed is still very far behind the curve. I don't know if you have a comment to that before I round out the calendar a bit here.
Yeah, sure. So the quick comment is that a lot of people on Twitter and other of our colleagues in the industry are using this Goldman Sachs financial condition index, but that index is putting on a reasonably large weight on equities, and the Fed presumably is using their own internal indicator, which is produced by the Chicago Fed. It's called the Adjusted National Financial Condition Index, and it uses way more variables than the Goldman Sachs one. And they have a less focus on the equity market, but on money market, credit spreads, etc. A lot of different other things, credit surveys from banks. And if you look at the adjusted number that came out up until the 25th of March, so a week ago, the financial condition actually tightened, and it tightened to a level that is beyond the peak we had in late 2016. So if you sort of exclude the big peak we had during the pandemic, this is the highest in a normal period in terms of financial conditions since 2012, when we were still dealing with the aftermath of the euro area crisis. So, and when you're factoring the 50 basis point move likely to happen in May and beyond, these financial conditions will soon reach the level of zero on this index, which will mean that we are getting to the level of serious headwinds for equities if history repeats itself.
Yeah, we'll have to pick apart what that index is covering. I imagine a lot of it has to do with the yield curve, and especially mortgage rates having spiked to the degree they have. And of course, those will have implications. But as we know, central bank tightening operates with a long and variable lag. So in the meantime, I guess the Goldman Sachs side is more market focused versus the official one from the Chicago Fed. So interesting tension there, to say the least, as I think our little discussion revealed there. So we'll have to see how that shakes out. In any case, that PCE could be interesting today. I'm not sure. I don't know how much the market's going to pick up on it unless it's a surprisingly large upside surprise that might get a little bit more energy back into Fed expectations, et cetera. We also have the weekly claims data later, and next week, the only calendar item I'm seeing from the Fed, if there was supposed to be an event that saw the Fed coming out, it would be on Tuesday, we have Vice Chair Brainard out speaking on inflation at some virtual conference. But let's watch for that and see how things develop. Watch for the OPEC meeting. And if you're a grain trader, watch definitely for that prospective planting report, as Ole indicated, a very important one for the grain market. For today, that's a wrap. We'll be back tomorrow with Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.